The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Greetings, everyone. I'm Jennifer Green for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is That's a Laugh. For the next half hour, I'll be reading excerpts of funny stories, quotes, and other anecdotes from various sources that we hope will add a few chuckles to your day. Are you thinking about being a leader? Not quite sure how to get started as a boss? We have you covered. Today we'll be reading from the book, Please Don't Sit on My Bed in Your Outside Clothes, Essays, published in 2021 and written by American comedian and New York Times best-selling author Phoebe Robinson, who has words of wisdom for Black women leaders and those who support them. Today's episode is part one of an excerpt from her chapter, Guide to Being a Boss, from someone who has been building a mini empire for the past 2 years and counting. I always assumed I would start a production company in my 40s, but ABC Signature, wanting to take me off these dodgy freelancer streets and put a ring on it, trumped any arbitrary timetable I had set for myself. If they believed I could handle all the responsibilities that came with running a production company in my 30s, then why shouldn't I? After all, it seems as though many people are good at their jobs because they developed many of their skills on the job, and I'm a quickish study, so this shouldn't be too difficult of an endeavor, right? Call this a classic case of you don't know what you don't know. Because I'd been freelancing for several years, I assumed that starting a production company would be like any of my other hustles. Anyone who has freelanced before can understand that assumption. You start out hopeful and rosy, and then immediately you are bedraggled as F. Every single day of freelance life was comprised of endless, many heavy lifts. Drumming up work, booking stand-up gigs, auditioning, doing paid and unpaid writing gigs, tracking down payment for work I did weeks and weeks ago, strategizing which bills I could be late on so that I had enough money to pay my rent, and sometimes taking jobs that underpaid but overextended me because some money was better than no money, etc. Therefore, as exciting as the offer of running my own company was, part of me was too locked into a grizzled vet mindset and believed it would be taxing the way my work had always been. So I didn't fully comprehend just how my career and life were going to change. No longer was it going to be just May. You'll learn all about my second in command in my Black Girl Will Travel essay. And me against the world. Contracts were signed, expectations from everyone, especially myself, were born. I was founding a company. I was going to be a boss with 3 whole employees and counting, as I would soon find out. We'll get to that in a second. But first, more about tiny reparations. The company was put together while I was in the middle of my stand-up tour. So when we weren't on the road, May and I looked at office spaces, interviewed people to fill the head of development and personal assistant positions, wrote an employee handbook, and had countless discussions about everything from fundamentals, monthly overhead costs, health insurance plans, defining the office culture, to the minutia. Where do we want to hang the artwork? How many team-building lunches do we want? Is it a bit much to get matching U2 t-shirts for everyone? The answer is yes, but I still did it, and then ended up keeping all 4 shirts for myself because, frankly, I realized how ignorant I was being. Then there was the matter of the production company, you know, producing something. The studio wanted me to come up with a TV show for me to star in, so I was meeting showrunners and began brainstorming. Before I knew it, months later, Tiny Reparations officially launched while I was in Scotland for the Edinburgh Festival Fringe. Word to the wise. If you have to start a business venture remotely, make sure it's not in a place like Edinburgh. That's just unseasoned food and personalities. Once I returned home, Tiny Rep demanded my undivided attention. I started production on a limited-run talk show for Comedy Central while developing an idea for a scripted series with showrunner and all-around wonderful human being, Jonathan Groff. And then I did the only sensible thing. I put my dream of running a literary imprint on the back burner. Yeah, I'm aware how this sounds. I spent so much time at the beginning of this essay lamenting how much I secretly wanted to get out of all my responsibilities. Yet the more I write, it's obvious that I was on the path to building an empire. What can I say? I contain multitudes, y'all. And I'm not the only one. All of us do, which is what keeps life interesting or tiring, depending on who you ask. So this is why, despite my countless protests about working too much, I would still dream about launching an imprint. Speaking of which, the idea for that came about over a rainy afternoon lunch with my then soon-to-be lit agent, Robert, way back in 2014. He and I quickly bonded over our shared love of pop culture, corny jokes, attractive men, and a penchant for planning for the future. Sensing that I'm not a one-book-and-done kind of author, he asked me what my endgame was. I knew that, for a time, Toni Morrison was a book editor while she wrote her own, and though I'm forever impressed by her ability to juggle, I felt that was, you guessed it, way too much work. So I told Robert, editing is too time-consuming, so I'll just have my own imprint instead. I still chuckle at this. The word just is so hilarious and lovably innocent. Just, I'll just have an imprint, was said with the same casual energy I have when, after a waiter presents all the dessert options, I say, I'll just have the check. Thanks. I swear I wasn't trying to play it cool. I honestly had no idea really what all went into running an imprint. I just loved reading books and believed that having my own imprint would allow me to be surrounded by books all the time, which is actually correct. My apartment with Beckoff currently looks like an indie bookstore called One Day I'll Read All These Books, but honestly, I'll just keep buying more and trip over them. This store is not very successful, guys. Anyway, ever since that lunch, Robert and I would briefly talk about an imprint, and I'd claim it wasn't the right time because my plate was full, and late 2019/early 2020 was no exception. And yet, I decided to do an exploratory call with Plume, the publisher of my two previous books. Okay, we can all agree this is getting ridiculous, right? I was behaving the way politicians do when they create exploratory committees to see if they want to run for president. These politicians make announcements about how they're not running for office. They're merely thinking about it. Mm-hmm. They're full of it, and so was I. Telling myself and everyone around me that this call with Plume was not going to set things in motion, was nothing more than a sweet little lie that I justified with the following stream of consciousness thinking. This is just to loosely talk about maybe somewhere down the line when I'm older what running an imprint would look like, even though I'm not really entertaining the thought because, again, now this is not the right time. But if we can have an hour-long conversation and then someone can send me a follow-up email with a PDF deck of what the company structure would look like if I were to run my own imprint, which I am not going to do because I am very busy, so busy that I haven't given it much thought, except that I would call it Tiny Reparations Books. I've already written a mission statement. I've decided that I want to publish literary fiction, nonfiction, and essay collections, and I would like to be heavily involved and read submissions / meet with authors and agents, which, now that I think about it, let's thoroughly walk through my bullet point list of questions and the 3-page document I created about how Tiny Rep Books fits in the marketplace. But, again, and I don't know why no one understands this, I will not launch an imprint at this time. But also, I will 100% launch it and be overwhelmed, even though working this hard is the high I chase. End scene. Yep, I tire myself, too. But this was the story I was sticking to, even after the call and through the early parts of COVID. I was reading for hours every day, not solely for pleasure, but also to distract myself from the fact that the coronavirus upended every single project I was working on. The additional free time meant that besides reading, I also had time to think, which is how the idea for this book came to be, and why the literary imprint seemed more realistic than ever before. Diving into a new business venture could be just, there goes that word again, the thing that would lift me out of my depression. When I reconnected with hashtag Team Plume and my publisher, Christine Ball, after our initial conversation, it happened to be shortly before hashtag publishing paid me went viral, which only further proved the timeliness of my mission to have a highly inclusive imprint, not just on the author side, but behind the scenes. On one hand, it's frustrating that it takes a collective uproar on social media for there to be transparency about how authors of color can earn significantly smaller advances than their white counterparts. But on the other hand, you bet your sweet ass I took this industry dust up as a sign to get my piece of the pie so I can spread it around, because I remember what being a newbie author was like. When I was shopping around my first book in 2015, every single imprint, except Plume, Hobbs, flat out rejected it for the following reasons. Black female authors don't sell, are not relatable, and readers aren't interested in funny stories from black women. Only a year prior, in 2014, Pew Research revealed that the person most likely to read a book is a college-educated black woman. So what were all these publishing execs talking about? Did they think black women in 2015 all decided not to read black female authors? Like we're hitting each other up in Slack. Girl, we gotta talk about Ernie Hems. This was not to say that black women only read books written by black women. That's equally as limiting a narrative as the notion we don't read at all. Matter of fact, we'll throw some white authors in the mix, like one puts parsley on garlic bread, while at the same time we love reading black female authors. We are hungry to have them promoted and marketed to us so we can discover their works. This assumption that the dominant demographic would want to read everything except works from folks who look like them and have shared experiences is simply nothing but racism. I know that I didn't want Tiny Reparations Books to be yet another place that made debut, as well as established POC / LGBTQIA+ authors feel like they didn't matter, that their stories and voices weren't worthy. So, much like with my production company, Plume and I quickly got to work building the imprint of my dreams, which included having a black woman as the editor, and letting my publicist, also people of color, have a hand in shaping the PR and marketing for all the titles under Tiny Rep Books. And as I was jumping between book proposals, writing my own book, and developing and pitching TV shows, while Hollywood slowly started to return to form, as well as leading team meetings and checking in on how my employees were doing mentally in the wake of quarantining indefinitely, and the mental anguish that summer 2020 brought, it dawned on me, I'm a boss. I mean, yes, I knew I was the one in charge, who did the hiring and firing and set the tone for the company, blah, blah, blah. But all the nuances, as well as the micro and macro facets of what being a boss entails, being a leader, having to manage people and their expectations, observing dynamics between coworkers, being an example of how to execute conflict resolution, understanding that weekly I would be making hundreds of decisions regarding the big and little things, maintaining my own mental health, etc., and everything else in between? Oof, all things I didn't truly understand how much they factored into the totality of my newfound position. There was so much I didn't know, and even more I didn't know I was supposed to know, but that wasn't because I wasn't trying. I listened to business podcasts hosted by entrepreneurs such as Gary Vaynerchuk, read books including Kim Scott's Radical Candor, Be a Kick-Ass Boss Without Losing Your Humanity. And I peeped profiles on executives in magazines such as Fast Company and watched interviews by successful business people. Real talk, most of these interviews and resources are garbage. For every good one, Simon Sinek's Leaders Eat Last, there's usually a litany of old, crusty, white dudes who are 11 years old and worth $2 billion delivering the same tired advice that sounds great on a magnet or looks pretty written in calligraphy on social media. Invest in yourself. Build a reliable network. Don't be afraid to make mistakes. It's perfectly serviceable, yet absolutely surface-level information that's devoid of specificity and insight into what it takes to run your own business or build an empire. What I needed and wanted was for these business luminaries to be frank about the nitty-gritty of what it's like when you're no longer working for the man, but are the man. Just once, I wish someone said, "Ho, why are you suggesting bowling night for team building? They do not want to hang out with you outside of work hours." Or, please understand that if you email your employees at 5:53 p.m., asking them to do last-minute work, the only reason they're not putting in their 2 weeks' notice is because you got them that good health insurance. A blunt, "Aw, it's so cute that you hoped to save money by stocking the office with low-budget snacks. People did not join your whittle startup so that when they are stressed out, they could comfort themselves with whack-ass reduced-fat Utz chips." Would have been nice. An honest, "Hey, boo, here's the deal. The office printer you bought will almost always never be used for professional purposes. And when the print box appears on your employees' computer screens, they will absolutely bypass the option to print in black and white." Yep, that's right. They're going to use up all that cyan and magenta ink printing out their StubHub ticks for Dear Evan Hansen. And you better not say crap about it. Ought to be mandatory information given to all new bosses and business owners. And finally, I would have appreciated advice specifically about being a black female boss. There's not a lot of information or books on that topic, and what does exist, you really have to dig to find. Like, where's Lean In for Us? Now, it doesn't matter whether you agree with everything in Sheryl Sandberg's book. There's no denying that it broke through the zeitgeist as a solid resource women can refer to. However, the same isn't true about BW leadership. The ones that tend to break out are books such as Year of Yes by Shonda Rhimes, which is great, but is more about her personal journey transforming her life over the course of a year and less concerned with getting down to brass tacks when it comes to business in the way I had hoped. Thankfully, it appears the tide is turning, and no longer is there a complete dearth of business books written by black women as there used to be. Folks such as Minda Hartz, author of The Memo, What Women of Color Need to Know to Secure a Seat at the Table, and executives Elaine Merrill Brown, Marcia Haygood, and Rhonda Joy McLean, co-authors of The Little Black Book of Secrets, are a part of the latest generation of business books written by BW. Thankfully, the conversation about black women in business is becoming louder and harder to ignore. So it seems as though there's no better time than now for me to join the conversation about being a black lady boss. If I may have a word, being a black woman and a boss is the shit. I know. Despite all evidence displaying the multitude of the black female experience, society is, more or less, intent on boiling us down to an outdated and monolithic narrative that BW in charge is nothing more than just breaking down one civil rights barrier after another, delivering rousing speeches at the ready, and Negro spiritual humming when the going gets rough. The common perception is that being a black woman in a leadership role equals overcoming obstacles only to encounter more trials and tribulations. And while I didn't believe that, I was still a bit anxious about what it would be like for me, since I didn't have personal examples to use as reference points. I've never had a black female high school teacher or college professor. Same goes for having a black woman as a boss. Sadly, this is the norm, especially in entertainment. During stints at film and internet companies, as well as freelancing at various corporate offices, a black woman was never in a managerial or C-suite position. Not only is the lack of black women in leadership roles due to racial bias, it's also a missed opportunity for businesses to tap into a more than qualified talent pool. According to the NCES, the National Center for Educational Statistics, black women are the most educated demographic in America when it comes to associate and bachelor's degrees. Damn, just think of all the black women whose maximum potential is not utilized and how their different perspectives could positively impact margins. After all, black buying power is $1.4 trillion, is projected to grow to $1.8 trillion by 2024, according to the Seelig Center for Economic Growth, and is outgrowing white buying power. Oh, really? Okay, listen up, white people. You have been put on notice. If you want to keep up with us, y'all need to start shopping more at Madewell and buying Tresemme and Vidal Sassoon. Clearly, I don't know what kind of shampoo y'all use. In bulk, because we are leading the charge and will eventually become the de facto market that's catered to. Meaning, elevator music at the dentist's office will be Al Jarreau. How effing old am I? Tiny bottles of cocoa butter lotion will replace mints on pillows at hotels. And the Nash Anth on good days will be September by Earth, Wind & Fire. And on days when we're feeling petty, Hope She Cheats on You with a Basketball Player by Marcia Ambrosius, because that is specific and bitter as F, and some days, that's how we're all feeling. Anyway, what I'm getting at is black women have so much to offer as bosses, but because of the constant negative media depiction of us, we are underpaid, disrespected, and discriminated against when we're clearly qualified, and as a result, we're not considered for leadership positions. And outside of Shonda Rhimes, there weren't a whole host of examples to call on that I could use as guidance in building the kind of career I imagined for myself, which not only saddened me, but fueled me to be the black lady boss I didn't have in my life. So, For all my employees, I'm passionate, funny, thoughtful, incisive, decisive, compassionate, artsy, intense, and collaborative. I have weaknesses that I take ownership of, weaknesses that are slowly becoming strengths, and I believe that all of us at Tiny Reparations and Tiny Reparations Books can create incredible TV shows and books that are not only funny, but have something thoughtful to say. There's tons of joy in it. Still, I don't want to paint too rosy of a picture. My blackness and gender can trip up the ignorant. For instance, are there people who underestimate my business acumen because I'm a black woman? You betcha. Have I been underpaid because of the way I look? Absolutely. Have there been scenarios where someone around me underdelivered or was sloppy because they think black women will accept subpar quality? Hell yes. And am I hyper aware sometimes that I will be unfairly judged as harsh or mean or demanding if I'm not treating people with kid gloves? To say anything other than yes would be a lie. Although there is no true way of preparing for the uniqueness that is being a black woman who is also a boss, some insider information and personal experience working for a BW would have been greatly appreciated. So, this is where this essay and I come in. Stay tuned next month, my dear listeners, as we hear more words of wisdom from Phoebe Robinson, when we'll continue on to the next part of this chapter with What Warren Buffett Should Have Told Ya. For now, I leave you with these quotes, found on quotefancy.com. From rapper and record executive Rick Ross, every boss started as a worker. From actor and writer Peter Marshall, a different world cannot be built by indifferent people. From poet Robert Frost, by faithfully working 8 hours a day, you may eventually get to be boss and work 12 hours a day. And from American business engineer and businessman Charles Irwin Wilson, a good boss makes men realize they have more ability than they think they have, so they consistently do better work than they thought they could. And we've run out of time for today's episode of That's a Laugh. We hope you've enjoyed it. Please be sure to listen next time. I'm Jennifer Green for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. That's a Laugh is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. Are you enjoying the show? Do you have any humorous quotes or authors you'd like to share? We'd love to hear from you. If you have any questions or comments about this or any other NCRS shows, please call us at 919-832-5138. Our number one more time is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.